90.3.
The rhymes you're about to hear me recite are dedicated to all of those that bite.
Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel's become the first country in the world to administer COVID-19 vaccines to more than 10% of its population. As of Monday, 14% of Israelis had received a vaccine, far higher than any other country. Despite the fast rollout, Israel's health minister says a total lockdown is needed to combat the surging number of new infections. This comes as human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, where about 1,500 people have died during the pandemic. Physicians for Human Rights recently said, quote, Israel bears moral and humanitarian responsibility for vaccinating the Palestinian population under its control, unquote. Israel is, however, offering vaccines to Jewish settlers living in the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Israel's defended its actions, citing the Oslo peace accords, which put Palestinian authorities in charge of health care in the West Bank and Gaza. Palestinian officials are facing a number of hurdles in launching its own vaccine campaign, including a shortage of money, lack of access to vaccines, lack of infrastructure to distribute a vaccine. Israel has so far been relying on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which needs to be stored at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. Storing such a vaccine is impossible in Gaza, where residents often go 12 or more hours a day without electricity. In 2014, Israel bombed Gaza's only power plant in what Amnesty International described as collective punishment of Palestinians. We go now to the West Bank city of Ramallah, where we're joined by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, physician, member of the Palestinian parliament, head of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, has been leading efforts to manage the pandemic in the West Bank and Gaza. He was infected with COVID-19 in December. He's Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative, a political party, and he was a presidential candidate in the 2005 elections. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Dr. Barghouti. Can you explain what is happening? How has Israel become the country that has vaccinated more of its population than any country in the world, and yet Palestinians are not getting vaccinated? Who's in charge of this program? Who should be?
Well, thank you, Amy. I'm glad to be with you. Israel actually is violating international law because it is denying its responsibility as an occupying power. Israel managed to get 14 million vaccines for it, the Israelis and those who hold Israeli IDs, but gave nothing to Palestinians. So practically, they are vaccinating 8 million Israelis and not vaccinating 5.2 million Palestinians living in the occupied territories. More than that, this system of racial discrimination, which can be only compared, in my opinion, to apartheid system, is doing something horrible in the West Bank. 750,000 illegal settlers, as you said, are getting the vaccines now. 3.1 million Palestinians in the West Bank are getting nothing. More than that, in the Israeli prisons, Israel ordered the guards in the prisons to get the vaccine, and probably the Israeli criminal prisoners. But the Palestinian prisoners, 5,000 of them, are getting nothing. What can be more clear here than that this confirms that this is really a system of racial discrimination? And when they speak that the Palestinian Authority is responsible, this is totally misleading. First of all, the Palestinian Authority approached them asking at least for vaccines for us, the healthcare providers, who are being infected around the clock, and Israel refused. The Palestinian Authority is in charge only of 38% of the West Bank, only. 62% of the West Bank is Area C, under full Israeli military control, and Israel is doing nothing for Palestinians there. More than that, if the Palestinian Authority tries to import a vaccine from outside, they will need Israeli permit. And Israel did not allow any permit yet for Palestinians. Israel controls the borders, controls the import, controls the export. And the biggest disaster is in Gaza, because in Gaza, you have 2.1 million besieged by Israel, lacking health facilities, lacking equipment. And there, they are not getting any vaccines. And more than that, 70% of them are refugees displaced from their land in 1948. When you tell them go and quarantine, I don't know how they can do that if you have 10 people living in two rooms. It's impossible. The problem is that the rate of infection today in the West Bank and Gaza is 36%, while in Israel it's 4.5%. Israelis are getting the vaccines and Palestinians are getting nothing.
Well, Dr. Barghouti, isn't it in the interest of Israel from a public health perspective, even if they want to pursue this continued antagonistic policy toward the Palestinians, to have the Palestinians vaccinated to reach herd immunity in the total area?
You're absolutely right. In my opinion, Netanyahu and his government, this man is so racist. He only thinks of himself. He only thinks of his political future. He only thinks of escaping the criminal charges against him and being reelected again. And all he does is to satisfy the Israeli right-wing voters. In reality, what his government is doing is actually hurting the Israelis as well, because you cannot reach herd immunity if you have 8 million people vaccinated and 5.2 million people not vaccinated, especially that 130,000 workers will continue to go to Israel for work and will interact with Israelis, of course. And there are 750,000 other Israelis, illegal settlers in the West Bank, will continue to commute and communicate with the 3.1 million unvaccinated Palestinians. So practically, this is a crime against Palestinians and a crime against the health of Israelis. It's a violation of the international law, but also it's, in my opinion, the worst crime against medical ethics, which says nobody should be discriminated against because of anything, which says do no harm and help people as much as you can as a health professional.
I wanted to ask you, the COVAX facility that the World Health Organization established to help poor countries has pledged to vaccinate 20% of Palestinians. Where does that stand right now in terms of that pledge?
I am in communication with the head of WHO here, and they're trying their best, but they do not think they can get anything here before 4 or 5 months, and if they are lucky. up till now, they don't know what vaccine they can get in. Up till now, they don't know how to get vaccines. That's why, given the huge spread now of community infections in the West Bank and Gaza, a very high number of cases. I estimate we have already 600,000 cases. And they approached the Israelis. The WHO approached Israel, asking at least for vaccines for the health professionals. Israel refused and continues to refuse. So unfortunately, we are looking here at a potential real serious disaster. And as a person who is suffering from COVID-19 now, after nine months of being so protective and trying to be very careful, I can tell you this is a horrible disease. I don't wish it for anybody. It's very dangerous. It can be destructive. It can kill the people. And it can also leave them with incapacity for a very long, for the rest of their life.
So, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, as you said, you yourself have COVID-19 right now. You're in the throes of it. We know that Saad Barakat, chief negotiator, died of COVID-19. You're a frontline physician. Do you get vaccinated? And what about the vaccines? PA has asked the United Arab Emirates to share some of its supply of Chinese-made vaccine, and the Palestinian Authority has reportedly ordered 4 million doses of the Russian Sputnik vaccine. When are these doses going to come? And what are you demanding of the not only Israeli government, but the U.S. government, since it gives so much money to the Israeli government?
I think I demand from the whole international community to do two things. First of all, to exercise immediate pressure on Israel to allow the passage of vaccines to at least in the beginning, to the health professionals that are taking care of people so that the health system would not collapse, and then to the elderly, of course, etc. But also we're asking the international community to provide aid bypassing Israel. Israel will not respond, and the international community has a big duty here. I was not vaccinated. No health professional in the West Bank has been vaccinated yet, and we don't know when we will get this vaccine. And it is really critical because the rate of infection is going up, and it is affecting, it could affect everybody in the community. So what we need is immediate pressure. Regarding the Russian vaccine, yes, there was a request, but I don't think the Russians can provide such vaccines because their capacity of production is still low. They produce only 500,000 up till now vaccines, and their maximum capacity is 4 to 5 million per month, and they need 100 million vaccines for Russia itself. So I don't think that is a solution, although the Sputnik vaccine seems to be very good. I think what we need is to really have a way of getting the AstraZeneca or the Moderna vaccine. Of course, we have a problem with Pfizer, although we have managed to provide some facilities in the West Bank if we can get it to give it to people. But the most immediate need now it's a health disaster. Now it's a very risky situation. A whole population is subjected to a very big alarming risk. That's why it is very urgent to immediately exercise pressure so that Palestinians also get the vaccines.
Would you describe this as medical apartheid?
Yes, absolutely. This is the worst form of apartheid. Medical apartheid. It didn't even exist in South Africa. This is just beyond description. Imagine you go to a prison, you vaccinate the guards, but not the prisoners. You vaccinate Israeli prisoners, who are criminal usually, and not vaccinate Palestinian political prisoners. Imagine you go in the cities of the West Bank, the settlers are vaccinated, and nearby Palestinian cities and communities are not vaccinated. Not only they grab our land, not only they settle illegally on our land, take away our natural resources, take away our sources of economy, but also they practice this system of apartheid. I call it vaccination with racism.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, physician member of the Palestinian Parliament, thanks for joining us. Thank you.
ودي أغني نسمة الحرية والحلم طاهر في الضماير عاش والوردة حمرة مفتحة من الدية والدنيا جاية لسه ما عشناهاش ولسه بيا للهوى شلها وطرف شلها في الهوى رعاش والغنو دال عاشقين عدلا لما القلوب قالت وصوتنا انحاش والأهلنا الجدعان والأصلاء وللصبا
I'm Deanna Buzu.
And I'm Omar Badar.
And today, for our last episode in 2020, we're taking a look back at what the year has meant for Palestine and what 2021 may hold.
Now, of course, 2020 has been an extremely difficult year for just about everyone. I mean, the coronavirus pandemic has killed more than a million people worldwide, well over that at this point. And beyond people who just got sick and who may have lost loved ones, the lockdowns themselves have also been devastating, with millions upon millions of people losing their jobs or being evicted from their homes. You have essentially a secondary epidemic of loneliness that is spreading. So the impact really is hard to conceive of when you look at this in its totality. And things were even more devastating for Palestinians because they did not just deal with the coronavirus by itself, but also had to deal with it under an intensifying occupation and Donald Trump's last year in office, where he was absolutely committed to changing the face of the region. So there has been a lot to deal with that has piled up on top of each other. Deanna, maybe we can start with talking about what life in Palestine was like this past year.
Well, this has been probably, as you've already noted, it's been the most devastating year around the world. And it's been one of the most devastating years for Palestinians. Just in this year alone, we've seen an upsurge in the number of home demolitions that Israel has carried out in the West Bank, including in East Jerusalem, close to 800, which is practically double the number that it was 2 years ago. And of course, this is being done at a time when people are being told to shelter at home and to stay in place, that Israel has used this opportunity to instead escalate home demolitions. And at the same time, we've seen that there's been an increase in the number of settlement housing units that have been either approved or constructed, with 2020 marking the highest recorded number of starts, of housing starts and settlements and approvals since we began counting. And this year alone, we saw more than 12,000 new Israeli settlement using housing starts. So while Israel is trying to get rid of Palestinians and get rid of Palestinian homes, they're at the same time taking Palestinian land and building more and more settlements. All the while that nobody really is paying attention because everybody is, of course, focused on this pandemic.
And when you hear about the pandemic, I mean, people are losing their homes all over the place. And in the case of Palestinians, it's really a deliberate ethnic cleansing is essentially what is unfolding, you know, in East Jerusalem and many other parts of the West Bank that Israel is trying to exert permanent control over. I mean, it's hard to find the words to describe how awful it is to be going through that on top of everything else. But when it comes to the coronavirus itself as well, there is this stark discrepancy given the fact that Israel is in control of everything in Palestine. And there's all kinds of discrepancies when it comes to even things like the vaccine now being spread around and the possibility of it getting to Palestinians. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yes. The coronavirus itself has been devastating to Palestinians for a number of reasons. The first is that there is no social safety net that's in place to make sure that Palestinians have some income, some stability in place so that they can actually work from home. There's also no stability in place when it comes to being able to do the simple things like have access internet and being able to homeschool. And that, but then on top of that, as you know, Omar, the medical system is a system that is itself held to Israel's military occupation. We don't have the healthcare system that is needed because much of what Israel defines as quote unquote security issues are necessary medical equipment that needs to get to hospitals. For example, there are no cancer radiation facilities in any of the hospitals for the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank. There's only in Al-Maqasid Hospital because Israel claims that radiation therapy has a dual use, falls under the dual use category. So even when it comes to things like being able to provide ventilators or provide much needed medical assistance, that has simply not been there. And so far we've seen that there's over 140,000 cases of people testing positive in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, and over 1,300 people have been killed by this virus. And in many cases, there are reports that say that some of these deaths could have been avoided with a proper healthcare system, but that just simply does not exist. And now here we are at the end of 2020, and people are talking about a vaccine. Inside 48, doctors have already been vaccinated. By the end of the year, people in nursing homes many of them will have received the vaccine, and people over the age of 60 will have received the vaccine. And yet there still is there isn't even any thinking about what to do with regards to Palestinians who are living in the West Bank. And given the siege that's in place on the Gaza Strip, it's highly unlikely that they'll even be able to send the vaccine to the Gaza Strip because of the needed, as I've been told, the refrigeration that is needed. And we've seen that tomatoes have rotted waiting to get out, and strawberries and you name it, and food has gone bad. What's to say that Israel's suddenly going to be so benevolent to allow the vaccine to get in? But we're not even there yet. The Israelis aren't even talking about allowing the vaccine in for Palestinians. So once again, we see this massive disparity in both the treatment of the healthcare system and in relation to the vaccine itself.
So we're seeing an example of Israeli apartheid, really vaccine apartheid in this case, and a huge discrepancy in the way that Jewish Israelis on the one hand versus Palestinians on the other are able to receive something that really has the potential of fundamentally changing life for entire societies that have been devastated so far. And Diana, when you talk about the fact that basic life-saving medical equipment is not allowed to exist in the West Bank or Gaza, because it supposedly has dual use. I mean, you're really looking at a situation in which Israel views Palestinians exclusively through a security lens, and there is a level of dehumanization that is required in order to view them in that regard, where life-saving equipment is barred because what if these people use it differently than it's intended to? I mean, that really speaks something really significant about the way that indigenous Palestinians are viewed by the Israeli government. And I think that it's in part enabled because, you know, it, obviously it's been ongoing for a very long time, but it seems to have intensified under the Trump administration because the Trump administration has really gone above and beyond in enabling Israel's worst instincts when it comes to how it treats Palestinians. There's been so much that has happened recently, especially in the last year, between normalization deals between Israel and other authoritarian Arab governments. You have the recognition of Israeli settlements as quote unquote legitimate by the United States' eyes, even though they are obviously illegal under international law. And all of this seems to potentially be having permanent consequences. This is not just something that fades out once Trump is officially out of office next month.
No, not at all. And your point about viewing everything through that lens is collective punishment. It's not only dehumanizing, but it's a form of collective punishment. The fact that every Palestinian is viewed through the lens of security, that once you go down that thread, once you go down that line of thinking or pull that thread, there is no end to it because everything can be viewed as having dual use. Everything can be viewed as being something that will affect Israel's security. And this has been overwhelmingly one of the major issues that we as Palestinians have suffered from, is that you can excuse all of Israel's behavior if you follow their faulty thinking of that everything is somehow security related. You can excuse settlements. You can excuse checkpoints. You can excuse allowing cancer patients from Gaza to come into the West Bank. You can excuse not allowing radiation therapy in Palestinian hospitals. You can excuse all sorts of things. You can excuse arresting children in the middle of the night, which is something that Israel continues to do even during the pandemic. You can excuse everything. And the problem has been with this administration, in particular in 2020, is that the push has been not only to excuse everything, but to actually normalize this, with four countries that are members of the Arab League coming forward and normalizing relations with Israel, but not just normalizing relations with Israel, embracing Israel. We see the UAE not just having trade relations, but encouraging travel, with 50,000 Israelis already having visited the United Arab Emirates just since the first flights took off in September. And during a pandemic, we see that that the UAE is doing advertising in Hebrew. We see television ads by the UAE. We see exchange of celebrities between the two. It's not just a question of having a business deal or trade relations, but it's really an attempt to extinguish us and to turn Palestinians somehow into a forgettable minority. And so this has been one of the lasting impacts. I don't think that the Biden administration is going to undo this, just in the same way I don't think that they're going to undo some of the devastating measures that Trump has undertaken throughout his 4 years in office.
What you're mentioning is in sharp contrast to previous normalization. In the case of Egypt and Jordan, normalizations that happened a while ago, it was more about, you know, keeping things quiet for the most part. There is an embassy, there is some, you know, quiet relations, but there isn't this celebration of Israel as part of culture in a way that we're seeing, particularly with the UAE right now, seems to be going above and beyond and sort of celebrating Israel. And it seems to also be matched with increased social media traction in the Arab world that really is filled with anti-Palestinian messages. Just all of it seems like a well-coordinated campaign. From a practical perspective, as far as the impact on Palestinians directly, I mean, one part of me thinks, what's the big deal? These governments never really meaningfully supported Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. You know, that they were, sometimes there's maybe humanitarian aid, there's some public statements in support of Palestinians, but in terms of the fundamental Palestinian struggle, there isn't that direct impact on it. But it really seems most of the damage is concerning public education and really the culture of the Arab world, where now there seems to be this concerted effort to erase Palestine as a central defining issue, which it has been for many, many decades for people throughout the entire region. You know, I've talked to Moroccans, I've talked Syrians, I've talked to people from throughout the entire region, and every time I tell somebody that I'm Palestinian, immediately there is an expression of solidarity that comes as a result of that conversation. And I think that that's what they're ultimately hoping to undermine. Though I doubt that they will be, I mean, I'm sure they can do a lot of damage because well-funded media operations can indeed have an impact on people's public perceptions. But I imagine that Palestine is too deep and too central an issue in the minds of hearts of so many that they will not ultimately be successful in entirely erasing Palestine from being a central defining issue through which a lot of people in the region really view international relations.
I hope you're right. I really hope that you're right. And I agree that when it comes to people, you know, we've talked about this, that these are agreements that are between dictators or monarchs and Israel, apartheid state. These aren't champions of democracy agreements. And I agree with you in terms of the Arab world as people. The issue more, though, however, is that a lot of this boils down to the way that the world deals with Palestine. And the more that Israel pushes for normalization and gets normalization, the more that we become obsolete. And one of the reasons that we saw that many countries around the world were speaking up and concerned about Palestine was because of the broader regional impact. With that regional impact neutralized, which Israel has wanted for quite some time, it no longer becomes an issue. And diplomats have been telling me this for quite some time. They say to me now their issues are not Palestine, that instead the bigger issue is Syria, Yemen, and now Lebanon. And that we're just an issue that will remain an issue, but not something that they're going to concern themselves with. So this is you're correct in saying that it doesn't really impact us on a day-to-day basis, except that it's like throwing dirt in your face on a daily basis. But it does affect the bigger picture in the way that the world views us. And this is why I think when we talk about issues like BDS, why BDS is so important, because it makes sure that these countries or that people don't view Israel as a normal state. And instead, it seeks to hold Israel accountable. And this year, we also saw that the U.S. government, that the Trump administration, even went after BDS with the recent Pompeo visit to an Israeli settlement, to a winery, where he declared that settlement goods are considered to be goods coming from Israel, and that any attempt to label such goods as somehow being not coming from Israel was going to be anti-Semitic, considered to be anti-Semitic. And of course, this is a shift in U.S. policy. It undermines the position that the Europeans have held. And I'm afraid that, again, this is going to be the new trend that we are going to see. But I wanted to actually ask you, Ahmad, what about this IHRA definition? This is another thing that we saw come out of the Trump administration this year.
Yeah, and honestly, those are related, Diana. I mean, you're talking about sort of this push to say that settlement goods are Israeli goods, and to dispute that is somehow anti-Semitic. It's an obvious attempt at suppressing public speech about an issue that should otherwise be pretty straightforward. Settlements are illegal under international law. They are considered a war crime under international law. And you have a situation now where the U.S. government under Donald Trump is suggesting that if you're not embracing Israeli war crimes, then you are anti-Semitic. That is effectively what it boils down to. And this IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, it's basically an expansion of the definition of anti-Semitism to include criticism of Israel or many forms of criticism of Israel under that definition. Now, the author of the definition himself, Ken Stern, said that this was deliberately designed as a broad definition for the sake of data collection, because they did not want to miss anything that could plausibly be anti-Semitism. But at the same time, he insisted that this definition should not be adopted domestically because it would undermine Americans' right to free speech. It would undermine the First Amendment and public discussion and discourse of issues related to Israel and Palestine. And what you have in this case is the very author being disregarded about the impact of the definition he himself came up with. And you have this rush by so many pro-Israel groups to insist on the adoption of this definition by the U.S. government domestically, which Donald Trump has done through an executive order, as well as social media companies. Also, there's pressure on them to adopt this definition and to treat any criticism of Israel or discussion of anti-Zionism as somehow being a manifestation of anti-Semitism. And that obviously is a very, very dangerous trend that is aimed, without any exaggeration, at undermining our ability as Palestinians and including our allies of merely speaking honestly about our experience and what happened to us. I mean, if you know, one of the things that's mentioned under the IHRA definition is that to describe Israel as a race endeavor would be an example of anti-Semitism. And so when you look at something like the Nakba, where Palestinians were ethnically cleansed deliberately in order to shift the demographics of the region to allow for a Jewish majority state to exist, to merely recount that event accurately is to engage in anti-Semitism. And that's just really insane. And I think that we have a very, very serious battle ahead of us moving into next year as this discussion begins to spread and gain momentum.
So now that we've depressed ourselves thoroughly, maybe, Omar, we could spend a few minutes talking about some of the positive things that we saw happen in 2020.
Absolutely, we should. And maybe on a related note, you mentioned Pompeo talking about settlements. Well, we have the UN on the other side a little bit earlier this year, coming up with a list of companies that are complicit in Israeli occupation and settlement expansion as a way of helping their accountability. So you have this tension, this opposing trend on some level as well.
Yes, and here in Palestine, one of the things that I was most heartened by was to see Al-Quds University invent and produce a very cheap ventilator early on in the pandemic in order to help deal with these shortages. So that was very positive for us here.
Yep, and you know, you can never underestimate Palestinians when it comes to their innovative mindset when it comes to dealing with living under occupation. It really is incredible to see how they get around so many restrictions in so many ways.
What about in the U.S.?
In the U.S., there have been a couple of things that I think are promising. One is the election of Iman Judeh. She is the first Palestinian state lawmaker in Colorado. This is exciting whenever we have more Palestinian Americans who are getting elected to public office. This is absolutely great. And we have a profile of hers on the IMU website, which people should check out. You have things like Brown University becoming the first Ivy League university to establish the Mahmoud Darwish Chair of Palestinian Studies. That's also really, really exciting. And I think most promising from my perspective is the fact that all of the progressives who have been outspoken on the issue of Palestinian human rights in Congress have been reelected, and better yet, more have been elected this year and who have joined them. So you have, you know, obviously everybody listening to us probably is familiar with Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and AOC and many others and people like Betty McCollum. And now you have Cori Bush and you have Jamal Bowman. And in the case of Jamal Bowman, he defeated an incumbent who is really a powerful figure in Congress. And he essentially was backed by the Israel lobby in a very serious way. What's really critical about this is that it busts the myth that somehow opposing the Israel lobby in the United States or calling for Palestinian human rights is the kiss of death of anybody's political career. And beginning to see that myth being busted, I think, is really, really promising moving into 2021 and the kinds of challenges that I hope we'll be seeing when it comes to policy on Palestine.
So moving into 2021, what do you think we can expect, Omar?
So I imagine that there's going to be the confrontation between the establishment Democrats, which incoming president-elect Joe Biden is very much a vestige of, and this new shift in Democratic public opinion and the progressive energy in Congress is going to intensify. I'm in a way you know, simultaneously dreading and looking forward to it. And on the one hand, I think Biden is going to really be an obstacle for a progressive shift in policy, and one that has really been long needed and is overdue. But on the other hand, I'm really looking forward to see what that confrontation ends up looking like, because we've seen Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and many others have successfully challenged the Democratic establishment on many related issues. And seeing that energy grow, I'm looking forward really to seeing what that looks like, and hopefully getting the Democratic establishment to begin to see the writing on the wall, to start looking more closely at polling among Democratic voters, which is clearly in favor of accountability for Israel and against this idea of a blank check for Israel to behave however it wants. So I'm hopeful that maybe we won't see a major shift in policy under Biden, but I think we'll definitely, I'm fairly optimistic that we're going to see progress in that direction, so that a shift in policy becomes more likely moving forward. But Deanna, I also know things are potentially looking more depressing on the ground, with the possibility of yet another Israeli election. Is that what things look like they're moving towards?
Yes. Most unfortunately, it's looking as though there might be another election, which will be the fourth election in roughly 2 years. And I'm afraid that if there is another election, that we're going to see either a repeat of election number three, or even worse, with Netanyahu securing even more seats. And I think this is because he has done a very good job at decimating the opposition. And Gantz and anybody who's in opposition has not really been pushing hard. In fact, Gantz himself capitulated to Netanyahu. So I think we'll unfortunately see more of the same, if not an even worse situation. But beyond that, I also am a little bit worried about what this Biden administration means. We've talked about this before, but I'm also worried about, I'm actually concerned about what these moves in the final days of the Trump administration are going to mean for us Palestinians, and whether the Biden administration is going to reverse them. So I'm worried about the issue regarding settlements being classified as goods coming from Israel. I'm worried about the issue of Israel's recognition of the Golan. I'm worried about the issue of the United States declaring and recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. I'm worried about these statements regarding the acceptability of settlements. And I'm concerned that we may just see Biden continue along the same path of normalization. So on the big picture issues, I'm still very worried. I think that we may see, we probably will see a resumption of bilateral relations. We will see resumption of funding to UNRWA. And we will see the opening of the PLO office in Washington, D.C. But these are all very symbolic measures, with the exception of funding to UNRWA, and that are not really going to the heart of actually liberating Palestinians. So that's the part that I'm worried about. And that's what I'm thinking of as we enter into 2021. Plus, of course, I'm thinking about whether Palestinians will have access to a vaccine and what that is actually going to look like.
Really, to me, what's most troubling also about everything that you're describing about the Biden administration is going to be the expectation of Palestinian gratitude for Biden reversing a couple of the symbolic things that Donald Trump has done without necessarily dealing with the fundamental struggle of Palestinians for freedom, which is going to remain ongoing. In a Biden framework is unlikely going to be given a significant enough boost in any meaningful sense. And that, I think, is the battle that for public discourse that is going to be so critical for IMEU to continue engaging in. This is basically what we do. We try to enhance people's public understanding of this issue as best we can. And we certainly have a challenge ahead of us under the Biden administration, and a fight that is absolutely still worth fighting. Deanna, doing this podcast with you has been great this year. Maybe I should have mentioned that as one of the highlights of this year as well.
This has definitely been a highlight for me. We've been talking about this for quite some time. And I really want to thank everybody at the IMU, and I want to thank the IMU supporters.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the construction of some 800 homes for Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Palestinian authorities have accused Israel of racing against time to build illegal settlements before President Trump leaves office next week. In 2019, the Trump administration said Israeli settlements in Palestine did not violate international law, despite a 2016 UN resolution declaring them a flagrant violation. This comes as leading Israeli human rights group B'Tselem is denouncing Israel's control of Palestinian territories as a single apartheid regime that violently perpetuates the supremacy of Israelis over Palestinians. In a statement, B'Tselem says, quote, Israel is not a democracy that has a temporary occupation attached to it. It is one regime between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and we must look at the full picture and see it for what it is, apartheid, they said.
غرام
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine. This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Quand vos parents ont besoin d'aide, vous êtes là. Quand vos enfants ont des craintes, vous êtes là. Quand vos amis vivent un moment difficile, vous êtes là. Soyez là pour vous, comme vous l'êtes pour vos proches. C'est possible que la situation actuelle vous fasse ressentir des émotions difficiles ou même de la détresse. Si vous éprouvez de la difficulté à réaliser les actions du quotidien, des solutions existent. Rendez-vous sur québec.ca/allez-mieux ou appelez Info Social 811. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Thank you.